Show how this is recasted in the Kohn-Kreimer algebraic approach, first of all for commutative quantum field theories. And then I will, before going to quantum gravity, I will also spend some time on talking about non-commutative quantum field theories, or more precisely, quantum field theories on the non-commutative Moya space. And we will see how the questions of renormalizability become highly more involved than in the commutative case. And despite these difficulties, we'll show how theories can become renormalizable and how this new type of non-local renormalization can be again recasted in this algebraic framework. And finally, in the last part of the talk, I will make some kind of a mirror analysis between these concepts I have introduced in commutative and non-commutative quantum field theories and quantum gravity. And at the end, I will, of course, present some conclusions and perspectives for future work. So when one has to deal to different possibilities for choosing physical models, different actions, different geometries, in this labyrinth of choices, one Ariadna thread which we propose to use here is the use of renormalizability to guide us in this labyrinth. Because renormalizable theories are the generic building blocks of physics, as far as we know today. Therefore, one can say that the concept of renormalizability lies at the heart of fundamental physics. In order to have a renormalizable quantum field theoretical model, one needs two major ingredients. First of them is the power counting theorem. So what does this theorem tell us? It tells us, amongst the class of Feynman graphs, which are the graphs which are primitively divergent, which means graphs which are divergent and do not contain subgraphs which are on their turn divergent. And all the divergences of the model will be obtained by inserting this type of primitively divergent graphs into bigger graphs. So for theory to be renormalizable, the result of this theorem, which is usually called the superficial degree of divergence, should not depend on the internal structure of the model. So for example, for the simplest quantum field theoretical model, the 5-4 model, the superficial degree of divergence denoted here by omega is equal to n minus 4, where n is the number of external legs of a respective graph. So this result tells us that the primitively divergent graphs of a 5-4 commutative model are the 2 and 4 point graphs. And it is only these graphs which require renormalization. Further on, in order to, once this power counting theorem gave us a good result, one also needs a physical principle of locality, which basically tells us that the counter term we need should be at the same local form at the terms of the initial bare action. In the Bogoliubov-Parasyuk-Hebb-Zipperman renormalization scheme, one then defines some kind of a subtraction operator R, which allows for divergences to be removed and for theory to be renormalized. Let me say a few more words about the principle of locality at the level of Feynman graphs. So this can be seen in a simple way by reducing connecting graphs to points. So if the internal propagators here are in some high energy scale, much higher than the propagators on the external legs, then this graph can be seen by far as local. So we have an example here with this bubble graph, which when these two propagators are in the high energy regime with respect to the external legs, this graph can be seen as some kind of a point, which is a translation at this level of the principle of locality. Now this perturbative renormalization was recasted by Kohn and Kreimer about 10 years ago under the form of some algebraic structure, which is actually a Hopf algebra. So this algebra, the main operation in this algebra is the coproduct delta, which is applied on the space of one particle irreducible Feynman graph. So the multiplication is just a simple disjoint union of graphs. And this coproduct has a trivial part where for any graph G, it is multiplied by the unit element, which is the empty graph. And then one has a non-trivial part where one sums up on all the primitively divergent subgraphs of the initial graph G times the co-graph G of a gamma obtained by shrinking the subgraph gamma on a point, if we are dealing with a four-point graph, or to a propagator, if we are dealing with a two-point graph. So this type of phenomena, where renormalization can be seen as a factorization issue, appears actually when we do analytic calculations of the Feynman amplitudes. So one can prove this type of property that the Feynman amplitude factorizes in this primitively divergent part times the part obtained corresponding to the graph where this primitively divergent subgraph was string. So this can be seen, for example, in parametric space or using some other methods also. The definition of the Hopf algebra structure is then completed with other mathematical operations, like the co-unit and especially the antipode. And these operations together were proven by Kohn and Kreimer that form a Hopf algebra. So the relation with the renormalization is that one can further define a map which, given a formal integral, a formal Feynman amplitude, returns it evaluated at the subtraction point. And this this comes to implementation of the renormalization scheme. So if this applies this operator R on the Feynman amplitude, this gives us the singular part of the amplitude. And once subtracted, we'll obtain the convergent part. And then one can define some, in a recursive way, some kind of a twisted antipode S in this way, which further on, using the convolution on the respective space, give us the renormalized Feynman amplitude of the graph, which is finite this time. So through this bookkeeping Hopf algebra structure, we have written down some kind of a combinatorial backbone of perturbative renormalization. Before going further, let me just say there's some kind of slightly different structure was introduced in quantum field theoretical levels, where the coproduct this time sums over any subgraph. And in fact, the renormalization Hopf algebra, which you saw before, is containing this big algebra as some kind of a quotient Hopf algebra. So one can say that we have a richer combinatorial structure since we take in consideration any graphs. And the Hopf primitives, which means the graphs which have a trivial coproduct. So if you remember the definition of the coproduct, we had a trivial part and then a non-trivial part where we are summing on primitively divergent subgraphs. So this time, this Hopf primitive will be the one-loop graphs. So when one does perturbative gravity, these one-loop graphs are primitively divergent. So this kind of structure can be appropriate for studying the combinatorial properties. Yeah.
Draw some examples of the difference between the two algebras.
Yeah, sure. So, if I take, if I take a graph. And take something like this. But this is not a five-point graph. No. So if I take a graph like this, if I have to sum in the renormalization of algebra, I will only have to take the two to sum on only the two and four-point subgraphs. So here I will have this one here, or this one here, or any two and four-point subgraphs.
So what does that look like? It just helps to see it visually.
If I take this subgraph, this is a 6-point function. Well, I think for this particular graph, I'm sure I can find a 2-point subgraph. So this would be just this the trivial part here, while if I use the other structure, I can have this here.
And the times one doesn't mean anything because it's just putting graphs next to each other.
Sorry?
The times one doesn't really mean this kind of, it just means.
It's just, graphs, just a so. Trivial part for. Yeah. So, for example, for this graph, if I'm not wrong, you cannot identify a tool, you cannot find something non trivial. While here, you just take any of these subgraphs, which is actually a 6-point function, then you sum up on them, you have four times this. But here you are not allowed to sum up on x because they are not primitively divergent.
Okay.
So let me say a few words about the Hausdorff cohomology of this type of Hopf algebras. To any primitively divergent subgraph through gamma, one can associate some kind of an insertion operator B plus, which is responsible for inserting graphs into graphs. And from a mathematical point of view, this operator B plus is what is called the Hausdorff 1 plus 4 cycle on the respective Hopf algebra. Furthermore, one can prove that any relevant graph in perturbation theories that are the quantum correction of the propagator of the vertex in a 5-4 theory, let's say, lies in the image of such an insertion operator B plus. So this is some kind of a translation in this algebraic language of the physical principle of locality that we have seen before. More precisely, if one writes the sum of Feynman graphs, it can be obtained as a recursive power series in the extension operator B plus, where K counts the number of loops, and G is just some parameter which counts this number of loops. So one can write down some kind of a combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation if one sum up to infinite number of loops. And the usual analytical Dyson-Schwinger equation, which deals with green function that we are used to in physics, are obtained by applying the renormalized Feynman rules on this combinatorial equation. The property that this operator, this insertion operator B plus, is a Hausdorff 1 procycle, translates at the mathematical level by the way it behaves with respect to the coproduct of the respective Hopf algebra. So this relation is given here. And it's just a straightforward consequence of the fact that this operator is, as I was saying, a Hausdorff 1 cocycle. And one last property I would like to indicate is that if we settle ourselves on a level, if we settle ourselves to a certain level in perturbation theory, so let's say we go up to a level n here, then applying the coproducts, so this is the sum of all the graphs limited where the number of loops is superiorly bounded by the index here. We can prove that applying the coproduct, this structure is closed. So we basically form some kind of Hopf subalgebra where this coefficient here are some polynomials in the previous variables of total degree n minus k. So actually, in commutative field theories, this type of property was used to give some recursive solutions for the Dyson-Schwinger equation in some particular cases. So I will now move on to non-commutative field theories and see how all this extends. So as I was saying, I will place myself on the Moyard space, where everything is encoded in the definition of a non-commutative Moyard product, which is manifestly non-local, but still associative. So the most popular way of implementing quantum field theories on such a non-commutative space is to replace the usual multiplication of fields by this star multiplication. So if we take the action of the 5-4 model, this action on the Moyard space just writes in this way. So let us now see what are the consequences of using this Moyard product instead of the usual product. So first of all, at the level of the propagation, which is the quadratic part in the action, by a direct use of the definition of the Moyard product, one can prove that one has the same propagation. So using the Moyard product does not change the physics at this level.
where the results are considerably changed are at the level of the interaction curve, where one can prove that in position space, the phi star term writes in a completely non-local way, but nevertheless, the 4 points x1 to x4 are constrained to be on some kind of a parallelogram. And furthermore, one has an oscillating phase, which is proportional to the area of the respective parallelogram formed by the 4 points of the interaction. So we have went from a local interaction in commutative field theory to manifesting non-local interaction, which can be represented in this way. One further consequence of this of going to this non-commutative setting is that if in local field theories the interaction term has a symmetry lambda over phi factorial because it is symmetric under any permutation of the incoming and outgoing fields, in this case the symmetry of the vertex is restricted to only cyclical permutation. So the appropriate symmetry factor is only 4, lambda over 4. And this can be seen in an elegant way by representing the Feynman graphs of this non-commutative theory by ribbon graphs, as I have drawn here. The use of these ribbon graphs makes us have make a clear distinction between planar and non-planar graphs. So what do I mean by this? If I take a graph where I denote the number of vertices by n, the number of internal lines by l, I also have a new topological notion, number of faces, which I'm going to explain in a few moments. And all these are related together to the Euler characteristics, which is equal to 2 minus 2j, where j is the genus of the graph. So in order to better understand this, let me give a couple of examples. So, if one has a graph with 2 vertices, 2 non-local vertices, 3 internal lines, the number of faces is nothing but the number of independent circuits which can be obtained on the graphs without intersecting the internal lines. So, for example, I have an internal circuit here between lines 1 and 2, another circuit between line 2 and 3, so I have 2 internal faces, and then I have an external circuit, so I have a total number of faces equal to 3. Inserting these numbers into the general topological notion given here, I obtain the genus of this graph, which is equal to 0, which corresponds to the fact that I'm dealing with a planar graph. Now, if I switch the hooking points of the lines 1 and 3 on one of the vertices, as I was saying, these 2 vertices are not the same because they cannot be obtained one from the other by a cyclic permutation. So now I have this graph, so I will have again 2 vertices. I will have again 3 internal lines. I haven't changed the number of internal lines. But this time, if I repeat this procedure and I go with my pen along the lines, carefully without intersecting any of the internal lines, I obtain only 1 independent circuit. And the new numbers inserted in the Euler characteristics give me a genus of a graph equal to 1. Which corresponds to the fact that I have a non-planar graph. One can see this also at the level of a simple tadpole graph. So if I have the tadpole of a commutative 5-4 theory, this can be represented in a trivial way, which is a straightforward generalization of the tadpole of a commutative theory. But it can also be represented in this way. But the 2 ways are not equivalent because I cannot obtain one from the other by a cyclic permutation. While in commutative field theories, these 2 tadpoles are completely equivalent. I can make any permutation and the graphs have the same type of behavior.
What is the role of the theta in this?
Sorry?
What is the theta a fixed? What is the theta?
So theta is just a fixed parameter. So theta is. So if one uses
a blackboard that we can.
Sorry?
We have a blackboard that we can.
So if one computes. The bracket between x mu and x nu using this one upload.
So that's the definition of the non-commutivity.
You can take this as a definition.
And is that allowed to be a function of position or fields or?
Well, usually theta has this block 2x2 matrix in four dimensions, where this is a constant. This is a constant parameter theta.
Usually so because people like to study that case or because that's.
I think this is the simplest deformation you can take of the usual, of the commutative multiplication. But I don't know if people study the theta depending on x.
They studied it. So there are actually a lot of mathematical works with a theta depending on x by Kontsievich and so on. What happens is that in some sense, if you take theta constant, it's the first order approximation of an arbitrary theta. So it's somewhat generic, at least in.
Anyway, here we're taking a constant.
Yeah, here I'm taking a constant. So when one takes it a constant, one can go further on in doing explicit calculations. So for example, here this field theoretical model are completely understood with a constant theta. This can be seen as the simplest way to deform the normal commutative multiplication. And I think that when one relates it to the cyber width, sees it as a limit of string theory in a background metric, theta is also a constant, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, there's no other. Can one take the bottom block be zero and just say
this one?
Yeah, just say for the coordinate be non-commutative.
You can do this kind of play. So the results we have here are for this both theta non-zero. And there was some people working in Vienna, Harald Gross and Fabian, which they took a degenerate theta, so one of them zero. They studied which are the modifications of the propagator in order to obtain the renormalizability again. But if one takes theta equal to zero, one has to take care of all the things I'm going to say in the future.
Okay, and last question, I'll stop bothering you. Is all this Euclidean?
All this is Euclidean.
Okay.
I can say a few words about Minkowski at the end, but it's a long story. So if one studies the renormalizability of this type of non-commutative series, what happens is at the level of this non-planar tadpole I have drawn here, as I was saying, the propagator is so far the same, so 1 over k squared plus l squared, where I have denoted by k the momenta of the internal line, and by p the momenta of the external line. So this this oscillating phase, which you maybe remember from one of the previous slides, given by the explicit formula of Moyer product, in this configuration, relates me the internal momenta k with the external momenta p through this non-commutativity matrix theta. So the presence of this phase makes that this integral, which was normally quadratically divergent in a commutative field theory, and was responsible for the mass and wave function renormalization, becomes now convergent. It's actually some kind of a modified Bessel function of first order. But what happened is that now the Feynman amplitude depends on the external momenta p here. So if one takes the infrared limit of this external momenta, this integral behaves like 1 over theta squared p squared. So this was first observed by Minval et al. About 10 years ago. And in one of our papers, we have proved that this is also true at any order in perturbation theory for this model. So when inserting now this graph into bigger graphs, this external line P here becomes an internal line. One has to integrate over. And this type of behavior will lead to infrared divergence. In order to reobserve these infrared divergences in your bare parameters of your initial action, one has to reobserve them at the level of the two-point function, because this is where this divergence appears. But this is a highly non-local, this is a manifestly non-local divergence. As I was saying, the two-point function, the quadratic part in the action, has the same behavior as in commutative field theory. The Moyer product does not change anything at this level. So it is local. So one cannot reobserve a non-local divergence into something local. So this type of phenomena is responsible for the non-renormalizability of this quantum field theories. So the situation remained like this until a first solution to this problem was proposed by Harald Gross and Reimer Wuttenaar. which propose to modify the propagator by adding some kind of a harmonic oscillator term, x squared phi squared, with some parameter omega, which is free to flow under the renormalization group. So they have proved in their initial papers that by modifying the propagator in this way, the model becomes perturbatively renormalizable at any order in perturbation theory. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this. I'm just going to say that most of the technique of quantum field theoretic, of commutative quantum field theories, have been extended to the level of this non-commutative gross Vulkan-like model. So we have worked on the parametric representation, first Razvan here and Vansani Vasso. And then I have worked also on some kind of gross Vulkan model where the X term is present in a different way. These results allowed us to define the Mellin representation and then to implement the dimensional regularization scheme for this gross Vulkan model. And I have also worked on the study of non-trivial vacuum configuration, because this harmonic oscillator term allows us to have highly non-trivial vacuum states. And several groups have worked on the possibility of defining gauge theories using these initial ideas of Gross and Vulkanar. But their main problem was that the vacuum state was highly non-trivial. So doing perturbation theories around such a vacuum state was quickly rather cumbersome. But as one could have seen with a free eye, the Gross-Vulkanar model, the modification they proposed, breaks translation invariance. So with Razvan and Vincent Rivasson and Jacques Magnan, we have proposed the following thing. We have proposed to take into consideration a new type of propagator, leaving aside the Gross-Vulkanar modification. Our modification is based on the following idea: to consider the quantum corrections, which I was saying they are 1 over theta squared p squared, any order in perturbation theory. So to consider a complete propagator dressed by its own quantum corrections, where one has a new parameter, which we called A, which is free to flow under the renormalization group. So the new action we propose writes in momentum space, where it has a more elegant formulation in this rather straightforward way. And we have proved in our original paper that renormalizability at any order can be also obtained for this model also, as well as for the Gross-Vulkanar model, but this time translation invariance is respected. Independently of our work, I have been in contact with some people which used this propagator for phenomenological insights coming from the cosmic microwave background. And the people working in QCD have used this type of propagator, independence of the non-commutative world, for the Glibov-Zwanziger mechanism for solving the Glibov ambiguities. As for the Gross-Vulkanar model, I'm not going to insist very much on the field theory, field theoretical aspects of this type of model. I'm just going to list a few results we were able to obtain. So first of all, the parametric representation, which was obtained also for the Gross-Vulkanar model, can be also implemented for this type of propagator. Considering the topology of the ribbon graphs, there is some relations with universal topological polynomial characterizing ribbon graphs, which are known by mathematicians of graph theories. So we have proved that there is a relation between the polynomials appearing in the parametric representation in quantum field theory, in quantum field theories, and the topological polynomial known by mathematicians in graph theory. With Joseph Benjeloun, which will be here soon, we have studied the renormalization group flow of the parameters of this model. And lately, we have obtained a generalization of this mechanism for field theories with other non-commutative products than the Moyal product. So before going further, let me say a few general words about the renormalizability on these non-commutative field theories. So we have seen that in quantum field theory, an important principle is the physical principle of locality. So when going to non-commutative field theory theoretical level, this principle of locality is is manifestly lost. This is why we do non-commutative theories, to have non-local theories. But we can say that we have managed to replace this principle by a new principle, which we refer to as moiality. So if the counterterms in a local commutative theory had the same local aspect as the counterterms of initial action, one can say the same for non-commutative field theories. The non-local moial-like terms in the action and the counterterms have the same form, so one can reabsorb the divergences in a redefinition of the parameters of the Bay action, and thus obtain a renormalizable theory at any order in perturbation. So at the level of Ribbon graph, this principle of moiality is a little bit more complicated than the principle of locality we have seen before. So let's consider some four-point function with two non-local vertices. So when one sends these internal lines in the ultraviolet regime or at short distance, we can glue these two parallelograms together. And the interesting mathematical property which has to be remarked is that the area of the resulting parallelogram is the sum of the areas of the two initial parallelograms if and only if the figure is planar. So if and only if we are dealing with a planar graph. And we want this property to be true because if we remember from the beginning of this part, the moial vertex had an oscillation which was proportional to the area of the parallelogram. So we can see this moial structure reproducing itself if and only if the graph is planar. But the power counting theorem told us that the sector where we need renormalizability is exactly this planar sector. So this is where we need for this property to be fulfilled and not into the rest of the series.
Of locality is easy to understand. It means that the Lagrangian is a sum of local terms.
Yes.
Is a single integral over local terms. Is the principle of moiality that it can be expressed in the same way with moial products?
Yes. So it's not local anymore. It's moial-like, let's say. But then the counterterms will be also moial-like, so you can obtain you can use the usual redefinition of your parameter in order to subtract divergences from your theory. Okay.
Is it still the case that there are non-renormalizable theories, say 5^8 in four dimensions?
So if we don't use this modification of the propagator, the gross Wickenhouse or ours, the theory is non-renormalizable. You cannot renormalize it. If we use this modification of the propagators for the 5-4 model, we obtain again a perturbatively renormalizable theory. For other models, one needs to investigate what is happening.
So, as you can see, these models have a planar sector and a non-planar sector. The planar sector always behaves like the commutative corresponding theory. For instance, the planar sector of the phi 8 model of star product will behave exactly like the phi 8 commutative model.
And therefore is not renormalized.
And therefore is not renormalized.
Yeah.
Right. So is there still a principle, I mean, for commutative field theories, there's a principle that if you write in dimension D all the terms of naive dimension D, power-carrying dimension D in the Lagrangian, it will be renormalized. Is that still the case with the Moyle non-commutative theories? Is it that you just have to write all the terms of the right dimension in Moyle products and it's renormalizable? And if you don't, it's not.
I think one has to consider this to have a closer look because of this mixing phenomena. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you can use this image in a non-commutative field theory.
Thank you.
So now that we have seen in a general way the non-local renormalization for this moial setting, let me show briefly how this can be recasted in an algebraic framework like Cohen-Kreimer did for commutative field theory. So this was done in a series of papers with Fabien Vintour-Naret and then with Dirk Kreimer. So the definition of the coproducts follows the usual Cohn-Kreimer scheme. That is, the non-trivial part is a sum on the primitively divergent subgraphs of the initial graph. But in this case, the power counting theorem as I mentioned, maybe too fast, was that the primitively divergent graphs are only the planar ones, the 2 and 4 point planar ones. The non-planar ones are not divergent. Then one can go into further detail and split this planar sector into regular and irregular sector, but I will not enter into all this here. In order to complete the definition of the Hopf algebra, one needs a co-unit and an antipode, which are defined in the usual way. And we have proved that this structure also forms a Hopf algebra at the level of the ribbon graphs. So as I was saying, one has to take into consideration the fact that the 2 and 4 point graphs, the primitive divergent graphs, are now restricted to the planar regular sector, as I said. And furthermore, one can define the Hopf-Schild cohomology on these ribbon graphs and write down this combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation, which can be seen as a recursive series on this operator B plus I have introduced in the first part of the talk. And one can also define this type of core Hopf algebra also for ribbon graph level. So the main thing one has to take care of, when proving that this structure is indeed a Hopf algebra and not some mathematical structure with no meaning, there are two properties which one has to take into consideration. One is shrinking of graph. So one has to shrink primitively divergent graphs inside a bigger graph. And another one is the inverse operation of inserting graphs into bigger graphs. So one inserts a two-point graph. So for example, you can insert this two-point graph here, so you have a bijection between the external structure of this graph and the point where you decide to insert it. Or you can insert a four-point graph, and you have to make a bijection between the external structure here, and so here it's only so a two-point graph, you insert it on a propagator, and the four-point graph, you insert it at the level of some vertex. So here the only vertex to insert is this one. So one has to make a bijection between the legs of the vertex you wanna, where you want to insert and the external legs of the graph you want to insert. And you can obtain different structures depending on how you make your bijection. So when doing this for ribbon graphs, one has to take more care, because if this bijection, which is actually called a gluing data, so if you make a gluing data which does not respect the cyclical order defined on the face or on the vertex, then you cannot have a Hopf algebra structure anymore. So if one defines a gluing data which respects the cyclical order, then you can prove you have a Hopf algebra which underlines the combinatoric aspects of your renormalization. So let me go further to the spin four models and start from a paper of Fotini Marcopoulou, which defines such a coproduct on the spin form space, where she sums on all subspins. So it's some kind of a core Hopf algebra of subspin. So one of the examples that she treated in her paper is this one. So what I have proposed is to quotient out this type of structures. Because one can actually prove in a simple way that they form a Hopf ideal. And I have chosen to work on this quotient space, where one can see in a clear way the graduation structure. And also, one can obtain these properties that I have seen in commutative and non-commutative field theories. Namely, when one applies the coproduct, one would like to have this type of structure both on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side, in order to obtain that Hopf subalgebra structures, where on the left-hand side one has polynomials on the lower orders in the graduation, which for the level of Feynman graphs were just the loop order. The rule was just to consider, for example, you consider any sub spin form.
And graphs. Two surfaces. You're thinking about spin form or spin inverse?
Spin form.
Well, then it's not a graph. The spoon form is much more than a graph.
You're talking about the weight and the...
No, I'm just talking about the combinatorial data. The spin network is a graph. The spin form is a two-dimensional complex.
Yes.
So the rule are...
But you can define it also on a spin form, no?
Maybe, but what's the rule then? I mean, it doesn't follow from what you have defined before because it's not a graph.
Ah, you just take so for example for this one you just take a so you don't first, you just take any subspin form and then you contract it into the bigger one. So for example, this one here is contracted here. So you take this one. This one is contracted.
Which one is contracted? Again, it's the same one. No?
Maybe. So here there is this one, just some. You contract it here, you take this one. Then you take.
I think, okay, I don't see the one. Can you break down the blackboard, maybe?
I was trying to figure this out, too. I think these are pictures which are dual to a 1 plus 1 dimensional.
Yes, it's a 2 dimension.
No, but that's the thing. Most spin form cannot be written as...
I'm assuming that dual to these tri-banded diagrams are a triangulation of 1 plus 1 dimensional space.
Yeah, in that case, but that's...
Yes, this is 1 plus 1.
But that's just an example.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about spin form are more general than that. Here, it's kind of a planar thing, so in general, when you have a...
You mean you have overlappings and things like this, or...?
I'm saying it's not the fact that it's not a graph. So what do you mean by a substructure there? Do you mean something that contains a closed bubble, or what's the?
I just take
you
some
don't have bubbles
in two dimensions. No, but he's talking about spin forms. So in spin form, you do have bubbles.
There was a rule for 3 and 4 dimensional spin forms. I don't remember what it was, but my memory is that there was a rule. There was a proposal.
You just take a substructure of your initial one, and then you reduce it in the bigger one. So maybe there's some Chinese, but I think you can
the question way. Is, and maybe we can save it for discussion later. But the question is, if you have a three, so 1 plus 1 dimensions. At least I think I understand what's meant here. If you have a 2 plus 1 or a 3 plus 1 dimensional spin foam, it's constructed from higher dimensional structures. There are tetrahedra, 4 symplices, etc. And the question is, what's the rule? What's the rule in the delta applied to an object which is dual to a higher dimensional manipulation? But maybe if you didn't study that, maybe that's a subject for discussion.
Yes, okay, what it means to be a substructure, because this is just a face of a spin form and it's attached to something. You cannot just extract a triangle, it's not consistent. You have to extract the whole bubble behind it and maybe more of that. So, yeah. What you're doing is fine for spin networks, but not for spin form.
Well, okay, maybe we can set up for spin networks then. So what I'm saying is that we are pushing out this type of structure, which trivially forms the Hofko idea, and work in the graduated quotient space, and define some kind of a grafting operator, which at the level of finite graphs was inserting graphs into graphs. So here it can be seen as taking this primitive structure and inserting them into each other with appropriate combinatoric factors. And one has an inclusion of the graduation by 1, and we can also see that the internal structure does not play any role. So in the core of algebra that I mentioned earlier, this insertion operator plays again the role of Schwarzschild 1 for cycle, it was playing it in the roles of a finite graphs in the quantum theoretical framework. One can then write down the equivalent of a combinatorial Dyson-Schwinger equation. So it's an equation where one has 3 insertion points for 2D. So in order to solve this equation, we restrict ourselves. So we sum on the graduation of the algebraic structure. So this is a parameter T in which we work order by order.
And this ansatz inserted in the initial equation allows us to obtain a recursive result where the elements C are given using the previous elements of lower graduation by the insertion operator B plus. So this type of Dijkstra-Schwinger combinatorial equation is different than the combinatorial equation considered in quantum field theory, and solving it in this recursive way leads to different results. So since, as I was saying, that this operator B plus is a quotient co-cycle for the co-product of the Hopf algebra, so one has this general relation which can be proven that is also satisfied in this framework also. And furthermore, if we sum up only up to a certain graduation order n, we can obtain this Hopf sub-algebra structure, where the left-hand side of the co-product are proven to be some polynomials in the previous in lowest order n, smaller than n, of total degree n minus k, where k is the order on which we sum. So I have computed for d equal 2 these polynomials, and also for d equals 3 and 4. And let me say a few words about group field theory. So if one considers a group field theoretical Feynman graph, one has, for example, this kind of tetrahedra with four vertices. One can identify two sequence bubbles in this graph, where another reason to identify this was given in your paper. And one can see that the final amplitude of this graph is divergent. So this is some kind of an indication for the structures to sum when defining this type of Hopf algebras. So this leads me to the more general affirmation that this quantum group field theoretical level is a better framework for renormalizability studies, because one can apply in a more direct way the tools we are used to in quantum field theory for this quantum group field theory. So insights of the renormalizability of this quantum group field theoretical levels in three dimensions were obtained in a series of papers of the people in your group, or also people in the group in Paris. So in the rest of the time I have here, I will say a few words about conclusions and perspectives for future work. So the main idea is, as I already mentioned, applications of these QF2 techniques to randomization studies of quantum group theoretical levels. Because we have seen that the level of a commutative field theory, we have the physical principle of locality, which underlies renormalizability. When one uplifts to quantum field theories on the Moyal space, which I'm more familiarized with, we lose the principle of locality, but we can manage to write down some generalization, which I have referred to today as Moyality. And the question to be asked is whether or not, at the level of quantum group field theoretical level, one can generalize these principles of locality and Moyality to some triangularity or superficiality or whatever they are called, which would permit us to have some renormalizability structures. At a more concrete level, some possible perspectives are the investigations of the relations between the topological polynomial graphs of tensor graphs, since the Feynman graphs of this group field theory are tensor graphs which are a natural generalization of the Riemann matricial graphs in non-commutative field theory. So these polynomials were introduced in a paper of Rezvan, and then people in Paris introduced the equivalent of the polynomials of the parametric representation for this group field theoretical level. So one can then perform this algebraic analysis in the group field theoretical framework and to see what this means. At the 3D level, in the paper that I have already mentioned here, there was this type 1 graph which was defined, which should satisfy this contractibility, generalizing this locality and moyality. So it would be interesting to see if also this algebraic level, one can define a coproduct where it is exactly this type of graphs which has a Hopf primitive and which would allow to form a Hopf algebra structure, and not other graphs
which could not be inserted through respecting the rules of the symmetry of the vertex, as we have seen is the case for non-commutative field theory. And finally, a last point I would like to touch is that we are currently working on trying to find out at the perturbative level the randomization group flow, the Friedel-Krasnov model, in a quantum group field theoretical formulation, so to compute the quantum correction of the propagator of the vertex at the first order in perturbation theory, and then further on if the calculations allows us to do this. So before ending, let me just show a citation of Dirac of 1930, which is saying the amount of theoretical work one has to cover before being able to solve problems in a real practical value is rather large, but the circumstance is likely to become more pronounced in the theoretical physics of the future. So with this, I thank you for your attention.
Further questions?
I have a question on this. Maybe because I missed the beginning. What sense this Kornheimer perspective helps to address the question you were interested in here?
What do they help?
Yes.
So Kornheimer is just a way of recasting the normalized original algebraic framework. So one can write down the Bogoliubov subtraction operator using these operations, which are mathematically ordered in a Hopf algebra structure. So I would say it's a test. So if a theory is normalizable, you can also test it if it satisfies these combinatorial properties of inserting graphs in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Then it is a kind of test for your normalizability. And also, when defining this Hochschild B plus operator, which inserts graph into graph, then one can see locality by the fact that all the pertinent graphs in perturbation theories, so for example, for 5-4 theory, all the quantum correction of the 2-point graph or 4-point function will lie in the image of such Hochschild cocycles. So I would say that if one wants to have a renormalizable series from a quantum theoretical point of view, this type of algebraic property should also be fulfilled somehow.
So did you check it for the group theory?
No. I was saying that this is something I would like to do in the future.
So it's a consistency check at the combinatorial level.
Anyway, in order for this to be properly defined, you need a power counting theorem. So as far as I know, we don't have a power counting theorem for this model.
No, but Kornheimer. Is there any power counting there?
Yes, but they accept it by hand. So when they define their co-product, they know that the power counting of, let's say, for 5-4, they know the primitive divergent graph are the 2 or 4 point function. So they sum up only on the 2 or 4 point subgraphs of their graph. Mm-hmm. And then you prove that it is a whole algebra structure, and you prove that randomization can be also obtained by properly manipulating your thing. So they knew that this power counting result. So as far as I know, in quantum group theory, we don't have such a result yet. So one can play with this, but...
No, it's associated to bubbles. So.
Sorry?
You know it's associated to bubbles.
Yes, but I would like to have a result which tells me, for example, related to the number of external legs.
So you can try the triangularity. So you can look only at the power. Because it's only a consistency check, so you can say, suppose it's just a 2 and 4 point function, then it doesn't work.
If you suppose this, yeah, you can write down and try to see if you can define a coherent algebraic structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's what you want. So that's the first position, no?
Yeah, but...
Good luck.
Yes. And also, I mean, if you have also this generalization of the physical principle of locality or osmolality, you can also have a meaning of your operations. So you know that this means that I have this translation of this physical principle at the level of an algebraic structure. So I don't know it. Yes?
Yeah, let me ask about a different application. Have any of these techniques been applied to quantum field theories on Kaplan-Minkowski space?
Which techniques? Any kind of the normalization techniques?
Yes.
I'm not aware.
Could it be, I mean, there the theta has the structure of you know, x, y, z, t. The permutation relation is x with t is a constant times x.
Yes.
Yeah, so that could be expressed in terms of a theta, but a very simple x-dependent theta.
A priori, one can type word for word what is the least for this framework. It would probably be highly more involved at the technical level because of the less simple non-commutativity. But unless the technical difficulties are so involved that one cannot overpass them, I'd say this program can be done.
Hey, but can I have a remark? The thing is that this mixing, the UVIR mixing, is rather generic in non-commutative quantum field theory. Mm-hmm. Turns out that for this simple Moyer space, we know already two solutions how to deal with it. I am not sure that we have a consistent solution to deal with the UVIR mixing in the Kappa-Minkowski. As far as I know, we don't have any good cure for the mixing.
Yeah, so I guess
maybe they apply the same cure that is they take at least. So here it was that we took the quantum correction, but the first loop, which was proven to be the same with the new, and we modified the propagator using that. And then we proved that for any quantum field theory based on a non-commutative product which deforms the usual product, this technique works. So maybe it would work for Kappa-Minkowski, but I'm speculating, I have no idea.
I mean, I think it would be an interesting thing to investigate.
Any other questions? Well, if not, let's send the speaker.